Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
When the earth moved, the houses fell to the ground within seconds, jolted when the ground stopped swaying and crushed everything that had remained. The girls were not the only ones left crying below. The whole street swayed. The earth rippled like a carpet, heaving itself of crumbs and dirt that a distracted housekeeper had forgotten to sweep away. I left my stand and all my wares, the piles of mango, the eggs. They would fall, smash against the ground. The packs of chiclets, the ripe avocados. And made my way toward the voices, not thinking of my own small house up and away in the hills. This is G.P. Gottlieb, host for New Books in Literature, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. And today I'm talking to Professor Miriam Chassy, whose fourth novel imagines the voices of survivors of the 2010 earthquake in Port-au-Prince, Haiti's capital city, that killed over 200,000 people, displaced over 2 million, destroyed millions of homes and properties, and unveiled deep-seated inequalities and legacies of Haiti's colonial past. To this day, there are thousands who've never received the help they needed to rebuild their lives. And Professor Chassy wants to remember what happened to a place that's a huge part of her being. I think of this novel, What Storm, What Thunder, as a plaintive and beautiful love song to Haiti. Hi, Miriam. Thanks for joining me today.
Hi, Galit. It's wonderful to be with you, and I'm looking forward to our conversation.
So it's January 12th, 2010, and the earthquake hits the center of Port-au-Prince, the capital of Haiti. Where were you, and what do you remember about that moment?
Well, the earthquake hit, if I remember correctly, just a little bit before 5 p.m., January 12th, and I was about to walk into a three-hour seminar, and so I received a text letting me know that something had happened in Haiti and to check the news. But I had to walk into my class and teach. So 3 hours later, I emerged to check the news to find out that a massive earthquake had hit, you know, the capital of Haiti where I was born, and immediately set about to contact my parents, who at the time were living in Canada. And we began a journey of trying to get in contact with people on the ground. But of course, for the first several days to a couple of weeks, most systems were not working because the earthquake was so massive that it knocked out, different ways that we could contact people, whether it was telephones or, you know, all of that. And that was actually my initiation to social media through a student to try and contact people who had internet access on the ground to find people. And that took weeks. And it was really just a terrible, terrible time.
I imagine so. So how then did you begin? When did you begin to write this novel?
So it actually took me 3 years to decide to work on the novel. I didn't start until 2013. And the reason for that is that, very shortly after the earthquake, My last novel had appeared, The Loneliness of Angels, and I gave some readings, you know, to fundraisers for Haiti earthquake relief at the time. But then I was set on a course for about 3 years of just giving talks on the aftermath of the earthquake, because I'm a specialist on Haitian women's issues and, you know, telling people best practices. So during that time, I was really engaged with survival, right, with people who had survived the earthquake and how we on the outside could help people on the ground regain, you know, their futures in a certain sense. And it wasn't until 2013 when that kind of work died down, and I had been a writer in residence at UWE in Trinidad, and I saw other Caribbean writers and artists engage with the aftermath of the earthquake, what it meant to them, that I realized that I too had something to add to that conversation as a creative writer.
Mm. Ma Lu begins telling the story by recalling the devastation of the earthquake. How did you decide to give her the first and last word in the novel?
Yeah, so the novel is organized through 10 narrative voices. And as you say, Ma Lu begins and she bookends the novel. That's how I think of her. And I gave her that responsibility, I would say, because I think market women are very much emblematic of places like Port-au-Prince. So when you see pictures, you know, either in good times or bad, we see pictures of these women carrying huge loads. But we don't often see conversations with market women. They know everything about the society. They encounter everyone. And so when I was working on the novel, I realized that the market itself would be a kind of actor in the novel, because everyone has to go to market, you know, for their food staples. But also that I wanted to give a market woman a central voice in the novel, because she would know so many of the other characters, but she would also know so much about the society. I also happen to be the great-granddaughter of a market woman, and I wanted to honor my great-grandmother through this character.
Oh, that's so lovely. So, of the 10 people, I'm going to randomly ask you a few questions. Richard is in Haiti trying to sell bottled water, which is really kind of funny. What's redeemable about him? Was it enough that he paid for his daughter's schooling?
So the way the novel is organized is that you have three different family groups and you meet different members of those families, you know, through those 10 narrative voices. And Richard is a multimillionaire. He's made his fortune bottling water and selling it all over the world. And he is also the son of Ma Lu, but he doesn't acknowledge that relationship and doesn't acknowledge that he's become very successful in business because he's the son of a market woman who is, you know, a business person. And he does finance his natural daughter's education, Anne, who you find as an adult in the novel, who has become an architect. And when we find her in the novel, she's actually working for an NGO in Rwanda. And what calls him back to Haiti is that Anne's mother has passed away before the earthquake. And he decides to turn this into a business venture. Why not sell water, you know, to the poor in Haiti? And of course, his return really has him face himself. So one of the things I was trying to do in the novel was to give a sense of a wide range of, you know, responses to the earthquake, both the experience of the earthquake and the response to it. And with Richard, we have somebody who is very wealthy, knows Haiti intimately, but has rejected everything he knows about it. Through his storyline, we see him come face to face with what he's abandoned and perhaps an awakening to the responsibilities other than his daughter that he has neglected. And without giving it away for your readers, you know, for the listeners and my readers, what happens to him is that he's confronted with the force of the natural resources that he depletes, with water specifically.
Yeah, that part was kind of macabre. Let's talk about Anne. That as a trained architect, she has a lot to say.
Yes. Yeah, because one of the reasons that the earthquake was so devastating to so many, this is, you know, Port-au-Prince was built for 250,000 people. and at the time of the earthquake had, I think, over 3 million. And so building codes have not been observed in many cases, especially, you know, among those who don't have the resources to build according to code. And this is not to say that there aren't wonderful Haitian architects. There are. And on my mother's side, there are a number of engineers who went back and stayed in Haiti, and their buildings did not fall. And I myself started in architecture, which is partly why I lent that to Anne as a profession. And so, you know, one of the things that she highlights are the ways in which Haitian professionals often don't have a say in the building of their own country. So even she, as a professional, is displaced to yet another country where she can find work, you know, to do, you know, the architecture that she wants to do. And, but then is called back by a colleague, you know, saying that Haiti needs her, but then also has to confront a number of things in terms of a level of devastation that she's not equipped to deal with. And so Anne is, in a way, you know, someone who knows Haiti intimately, but also doesn't have all of the capacity, you know, to respond. But she does what she can, and she does enter the IDP camps and does the kind of, you know, ground floor work that people needed to do in those first few weeks, which is to assess the damage and to go from there.
It took a little reading to figure out that the three families, that all the 10 characters, they're all interrelated in some way. What is Richard's relationship with Dieudonné?
So Richard is cousins, you know, distant cousins, as the novel says, to Dieudonné and another character named Léopold. And so Dieudonné is the best friend of Sonia, and Sonia is a sex worker in one of the big hotels where Richard is staying. And Dieudonné is, in the sense, he's both her best friend and her fixer. And Léopold is a Trinidadian trafficker who is of Haitian, you know, descent, part Haitian descent, who goes to Haiti in order to make his fortune, you know, through trafficking. And this is how those three men, Richard, Dieudonné, and Léopold, thank you, are all related. But in this kind of distant way that is very particular, or, you know, this is something that you find in the islands, that often people are related, even in a distant way, you know, within the same island, but sometimes across the islands. And so that's how I connected them. And that's how then they naturally find each other at the hotel and start having a conversation at the time, pre-earthquake, about the future of Haiti.
Do you think Léopold's experience during the earthquake changes him?
Absolutely. And this is part of what I was trying to affect in the novel, so that the reader has a feeling, a very intimate sense of what people might have gone through, not just at the moment of the earthquake, right, and then the aftershocks, but the ways in which the experience of the earthquake could really change a person, but change them in different ways. So in Léopold, you have someone who, you know, has been involved in trafficking and things that he has not really thought much about, except that he is getting older. He has lost most of his children because he was not a responsible, you know, parent. And he has one child that he still cares for, who's quite small. And in that moment of realizing that he might lose his life, he's trapped in an elevator lift in the hotel. He starts rethinking his entire life and rethinking the kind of relationship he could have with his daughter if he changed that life. And so, you know, but this is not to say that everyone who experienced the earthquake had a that kind of awakening. Some did not, but he happens to be one of the people who does.
Because you kind of want to hear about transformation after a life-threatening. Dieudonné and Sonia's relationship is, that's an interesting way to say it, that he's her fixer. I don't know if you say that in the book, but it's true. But she is also very important to him. She's beautiful and smart. And everybody is so concerned because it's not what they dreamt of for her. I found it very interesting, their relationship and how it was unusual.
Yeah. I mean, they're two characters that represent what in Haiti is called the M community. And so they identify as queer. And what is interesting about Sonia for me is that she comes from, you know, clearly a very poor family, but she's a very beautiful woman. And one of the things that she knows, because she doesn't have leverage economically, is that she has very narrow choices in terms of what her future might be like. And one of the possibilities is that she might be exploited, you know, because of her beauty, which is why she decides to become, she makes the decision to become a sex worker so that she can control what happens to her body and she can control, you know, who accesses her and then make money among the rich. And she has, before she meets Dieudonné, she just thinks, well, I'll become a rich man's mistress and this is the way out of poverty. After she meets Dieudonné, who's someone like herself, she realizes that maybe they can work together and they become the best of friends to maybe buy a house, maybe have a future, you know, with their chosen family up in the hills in Haiti, and that it could be something different. I mean, there's also a hint, a suggestion that she might be in love with Dieudonné, but Dieudonné is, you know, clearly more interested in men than he is in women. And so that she is satisfied with only having him as a best friend. But then, you know, what he tells her is that the most important thing is that they love each other unconditionally. And this is also what binds them, but also helps them to survive. And the other thing that helps them to survive is that they have a very deep spiritual connection to, you know, something greater than, you know, sort of the material world that one can see. And you see that at the beginning of Sonia's section, where she talks about Dieudonné having an intuition that something is wrong, that something is going to happen on this particular day. And he sees visions of a man who they both interpret to be Baron Samedi, which is the lower god of death. And it's what leads them to leave the hotel before they're ready to, in fact, but it's what saves their lives.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
The Vietnam War, it's over.
Your job's just begun.
A new HBO original limited series.
Welcome to the world of spycraft. Strap in.
From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr.
What are you concealing?
Based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel by Viet Thanh Nguyen.
What if I told you that I was a communist spy?
How did you become this?
The Sympathizer, streaming April 14th on Max. Subscription required.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Right. She's also interesting because here's the world she lives in, sex trafficking in a hotel. But she's so worried about her younger brother and sister. Cares for them. Can you say a little bit about Paul and Tafia?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, first, I'd want to say that they're not involved in trafficking. Leopold is involved in trafficking of drugs and, you know, different kinds of things. She is a sex worker, but she chooses, you know, what she does in the hotel. And one of her concerns is that she doesn't want her younger sister to have to make the kinds of choices she's making. And, you know, she has a concern for, you know, so whatever she makes in the hotel, she is making sure that the family has more than they do without, you know, the money that she brings them. And so she has a concern about protecting that younger sister, Tafia, who's only 15. And readers will encounter Tafia, who has her own section as well. And it's like any 15-year-old anywhere, where she's just wanting to, you know, find a best friend, be with the popular girls, you know, is concerned about who she might date, but is also being preyed upon in the ways that we can imagine Sonia might have been preyed upon as a younger person. And we have moments where we see the two of them interact, where Sonia, in her return with Dieudonné to, you know, that part of town where the family lives, is basically getting Tafia out of trouble, you know? But in the end, Tafia is going to go through some harrowing times, not only, you know, living through the earthquake with her younger brother at her side, Paul, younger of two brothers. He's actually older than her, but younger than the older brother who lives in the United States in Boston, whose name is Didier. But she is going to live in the IDP camps, the internally displaced people camps, which sprung up, you know, immediately after the earthquake, which were very insecure. And so in her storyline, the reader comes face to face with all of the insecurity in those IDP camps. And Tafia will emerge in many ways as one of the most, you know, one of the most insightful characters in the novel, because she'll have been through so much. And even though she's one of the youngest characters of the survivors, she'll be the youngest, but who will have been through much more than some of her older, you know, older siblings and friends.
So the older brother that you just mentioned, Didier, he's in Boston. What did it mean to you, that story? He's the only one who's outside of the country when the he's, the story.
He's one of two, because Anne is also outside.
But she Rwanda. Comes.
But she returns. She does return. Whereas Didier doesn't have as many means. So he's a down on his luck musician. I do come from a family of musicians on my father's side. So my father and his younger brothers are all musicians. The younger brother is actually very well-known musicians in Haiti. And so I kind of drew from my experience growing up with musicians with Didier, except that Didier is not successful in his bid to, you know, to venture into America and become a successful musician, which is why he's driving his friends' cabs whenever they can let him, you know, lend him a cab. And he also has to come face to face with a kind of racism that he didn't experience in Haiti. You know, Haiti has a lot of classism and colorism, but not the kind of racialized systems that we have in the United States. And so he's also confronting racism and trying to make sense of his new position while not communicating anything that he's going through, you know, to those he's left behind in Haiti. He's very close to Tafia. And so like Sonia, the older sister, he's very concerned with Tafia's future. And both of them have a little, in some ways, kind of neglected Paul. And we see that with Paul, who doesn't have his own storyline, but erupts in other people's stories. But Paul is also at a loss as to how to assume becoming a man at 17 years old in this country where everything is falling apart. But for me, the story of Didier is a little bit like mine in the sense of being outside and finding out about the earthquake from the outside, from the news. You know, so that moment when you read about him watching the Capitol fall, watching the cathedral, you know, on screen, because these were the first images after January 12, 2010 that were broadcast on CNN and Canadian, you know, systems. And I think for any of us who are outside of Haiti with close ties to Haiti, Haitian or other, when we saw those buildings fall, it would be like seeing the White House here fall, you know, or a huge monument fall. And what can you think? What can you imagine? And with no other images coming out for some weeks, we knew that something catastrophic had happened. And then how do you cope with that when you don't have a means of communicating with people? And in the case of Didier, which is unlike my case, you have very few resources. And so I was trying to imagine through Didier, you know, the lot of many Haitians who have limited resources, are immigrants, but are still have intimate ties to their home country and what they went through in the aftermath of the earthquake.
I thought they're all heartbreaking stories, but the one that really moved me to tears was the Sarah and Olivier. Can you talk a bit about Sarah?
Yeah, absolutely. Sarah, Olivier, and Jonas are another family group in the book, and they're young parents. They lost their two youngest children, daughters, immediately during the impact of the earthquake. And then their son, Jonas, survives for a period of time. And so Sarah is moved to the IDP camp with in the knowledge that she's lost two of her children. And she's really struggling to make sense of that loss in the camp. And others like Malou, a minor character named Loco, and even Anne, who returns, you know, are in many ways looking out for her and realize that she has entered a deep depression. And it's in that deep depression that we find her trying to make sense of how to live with this loss. And one of the things that's invoked in her section is a belief in Haiti that the dead are never really gone, that they live with us. And so she's looking for signs of those children and imagines a way, you know, to bring them back to life in a certain kind of way. And then Olivier is her husband. They're both accountants. And Olivier is from a more well-to-do background, and he hasn't suffered the kind of losses that she has in the past. So when we find Sarah, when she tells her story, she talks about losing her mother, losing her grandmother, and then moving to the capital to live with aunts and uncles who take care of her. And then she finds, you know, the love of her life, Olivier, and she's satisfied with that, as is he. But he really cannot make sense of the millions coming into the country at this time. So maybe 2-3 months after the earthquake, that doesn't seem to be trickling down to the regular, you know, the average person. And he leaves his wife and remaining son in one camp to go to another, which is based on a real camp, which was created to decentralize Haiti, to move people out of the capital and have fewer people in the capital during this period, with a promise of factory work. And so he moves there, and he's sort of ranting and raving about, you know, what could have been done differently in terms of this rebuilding period. And then, of course, we have Jonas, who's just turned 11 in this new year, in 2010, and who probably goes through one of the most harrowing experiences in the aftermath of the earthquake. He has a voice in the novel, too. And Sarah and Jonas were some of the first voices that came to me, in a very clear kind of fashion. And I think in some ways, they kind of carry the heart of a novel, even though they may be difficult for people to read.
Well, it's difficult to read of heartbreak and pain and suffering in that way.
Yeah. Miriam,
can you say more about how Sade's song Bring Me Home affected you while you wrote this book?
Yeah. I think people find that surprising, but Sade is someone I've been listening to since I was 14 years old. So I'm constantly waiting for the next album to drop. And as a writer, I find that she's an inspiration because she doesn't put out work until she's ready. And I sometimes go many years between books. She put out a CD that year, so in 2010, and that single came out, Bring Me Home. And if you listen to the words, the lyrics of that song, a lot of the imagery is about a broken land, a broken ground, and walking across that broken earth, you know, and trying to find a way home. And so whenever I heard that song, it just really, you know, it actually buoyed my spirits. The tone of it is very sad, you know, it's very poignant. So it matched the kind of feeling I had in the aftermath of the earthquake. When I started writing the novel, I listened to a lot of music, again, because I grew up with musicians. So I was listening to a lot of Haitian music, but I would listen to this particular song sometimes on repeat when I was writing the most difficult parts of a novel, because it really spoke to me about this wanting to, you know, not only bring myself home, which I did do many times after 2010, but also to bring the characters home. You know, whether they survived or didn't survive, but in a way that would make readers feel like even if Haiti is not their home, that they felt like they were going back to some place they cared about and wanted to see the best for. And so that's why that particular song is so dear to me.
I didn't know about it. Listen to it. It's a beautiful song. I'm going to suggest everybody, while you're listening to this podcast interview, turn on that song. So is there another novel in your future?
There is. Actually, when this novel came out in Canada in September and the U.S. in October, I started working on the next novel, which is tentatively titled Sisters. And I don't want to give much about it away, but it's basically about sisters who have the same father but not the same mother, and how their lives are very different once they discover their sisterhood.
Ooh, I like it. I'm looking forward to it. Thank you so much for speaking to me today. It's been a pleasure, and best of luck in your writing and your teaching.
Thank you so much for this interview and for bringing What Storm What Thunder to more readers, especially because this year, tomorrow, January 12th, is the 12th anniversary of the earthquake. So if more people know about it and want to reach out to people in Haiti, I think the novel is a great way for them to learn about the experience of the earthquake and maybe bring it home to themselves.
And thank you for joining me. Again, this is G.P. Gottlieb, author of the Whipped and Sipped Mystery Series and host for New Books and Literature, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. Today I've been talking with Miriam Chancy about her novel, What Storm, What Thunder. Thanks for listening, and may you always be immersed in a juicy novel. Happy reading!